We got a handful of money managers that we call our wise men. One of them, Si Jacobs, is with us today. So I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. You guys are really busy. You in particular, because you're very much a fighting general. It isn't 361 doesn't go into battle on their own. You lead from the front.
Oh, thank you, Alec. And apologies once again for missing a few of our previous meetings. Been pretty busy, but yep, we like to take the battle from the front if we can.
And it's been an extraordinary period. If you go back over the last few weeks. The election of Donald Trump in the United States has turned so many things on its head. From where you're sitting, has this been as seismic as is being interpreted elsewhere?
Well, I think the market's discounted a Trump victory for some time. He himself even acknowledged that months before, saying the market is running on the back that he's going to be victorious. And I think that is, to a large extent, true. I think the markets have continued to rally, not in an enormous fashion, but had we had a Democrat win, I would probably have guessed the markets may have come off somewhat. So overall, I think it's better for markets. We can discuss that. But I think the result was, call it 80% discount into market prices.
At the last conference, I'm going to keep reminding you of this. You said Tesla was your biggest short. I hope you weren't short on Tesla going into the election, because it has just got nuclear fuel, or some of Elon Musk's rocket fuel, in the last little while. But if you were short at 200, you got to be seriously short at 350.
So first of all, just to correct you, never been our largest short, just been a very small short. We do realize the risk of something like that, which is really a cult, which is not valued on the basis of any fundamental valuations, or, you know, anybody who did bottom-up work on the company and saw that profits were declining and margins were under pressure and EV numbers were continually falling short of their projections and the Chinese catching up in their models. You know, you would think this company should be valued like other car companies at 5, 6, 7 PEs, but maybe even at 20, 30, 40 PEs, given the upside of, you know, whatever else they're doing, which we haven't seen materialize ever on any false promise. And many false promises have we seen from Mr. Musk over the years. But it is a cult, and it's gone to 150 PE now, because basically he is co-president or vice president of the US. We were lucky enough to close our short around the election, half of it, I think, before and a little bit after. So we weren't materially affected at all by being slightly short. But I would agree with you, probably 360, which it touched a week or 10 days ago, you know, fundamentally it is a short. However, you know, be aware that unfortunately the whole world is behind him, and regulation can very much fit into Tesla's playbook right now. I mean, Donald Trump does owe Musk an enormous favor. I mean, the amount of followers that effectively switched from becoming Democrats, including Elon himself, from previous elections to becoming Republicans. I think, you know, Trump does owe Elon the world, and, you know, pretty much Tesla can, I suppose, write the regulation playbook as they see fit.
If you think that that was a beneficiary of the Trump surge, then you've got to be looking at Palantir with similar glasses. Even from my perspective, as somebody who was on board there at $8, when it got to $65, I did some analysis, and the numbers just seriously, seriously don't add up on that one. But Peter Thiel is a friend of Donald Trump's, has been for a while. So I guess the same kind of thought seems to be applied there.
I guess so. I mean, you know, winning government contracts is a big plus for Palantir. And again, you know, they're on the right side of politics. But again, the valuation is massively stretched. You know, would you ask me, would I hold Palantir at $65 or Tesla at $340 where it is now? The answer is absolutely not. You know, there's no safety in any kind of disappointment that comes out of those companies. And I agree with you. They're on the right side of the Trump administration, but they're on the wrong side of the valuation metrics.
What about Bitcoin before we go to a stock that I'd like your opinion on that's even worse inflated than those two, if that's possible? What's your view on Bitcoin, given at the various business conferences where you have provided keynotes for us? You've had quite a lot of input from Bitcoin bulls.
Yeah, so I'm not necessarily a bear or a bull on Bitcoin. It's a very difficult instrument to value. I think the whole mechanism of Bitcoin is exceptionally smart. You know, it does away with the borders for currency, your ability to transact for almost nothing on a global scale with any type of commodity, service, etc., to move money freely. But its issues are obviously in the potential for regulation. And obviously, I'm sure a lot of terrorism has been funded using Bitcoin. And, you know, even though Donald Trump advocates that he's very positive on the cryptocurrency market and he sees a place for it, then I'm sure he means a regulated cryptocurrency market. And it's very difficult to value something, you know, as Buffett said, that requires another buyer to be more positive on it than you and effectively buy those Bitcoins from you, because it's not a business. It doesn't pay you a yield. And right now, I think a lot of what's built into the price is obviously also this beautiful golden loop that Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy have started by effectively taking a listed company like MicroStrategy and issuing convertible bonds in MicroStrategy at big premiums to the share price. In other words, saying to investors, you know, here's my share price at $400. I need funding. So they effectively loan you some money. And I'm effectively giving you an option to get MicroStrategy shares, let's say, at 30% above the strike now. So instead of 400 at 520, I'm not going to pay you a yield on that. But what I'm going to do with the money that you effectively are lending to me is I'm going to buy more Bitcoin. So I'm going to create a geared play on Bitcoin. And effectively, he's been doing that almost, you know, every week or 10 days, $1 to $2 billion worth of Bitcoin. So he's become a natural buyer. He's tightening up the marketplace. And obviously that has led to a very strong Bitcoin price and touching, you know, close to 99,000 or 100,000, you know, basically on his last offer. And there is generally becoming a much more wider acceptance. You know, the likes of these BlackRock's and various ETFs and various financial institutions that are now offering Bitcoin. So as it's becoming more adopted, there is naturally more demand. And I don't necessarily see the price collapsing. As you know, for now, there's a lot of interest. So I'm not necessarily negative or positive. If someone asks me a question like, should I own Bitcoin? I say, well, have a little bit in your portfolio, you know, have a couple of percent, you know, but be prepared to know that if it halves, you're okay. But if it doubles or goes to $1 million, as some people are calling it, you get a nice little bonus out of having a couple of percent invested there. But it's not something that's core to what 361 does. It's not a regulated product, you know, and it's not a business. It has no underlying earnings or anything. So we're not necessarily that bullish on it. But I think overall, you know, there's a place for it in the world.
MicroStrategy was the stock that I was going to bring up next as even more inflated from a valuation perspective than Tesla and Palantir. Our view at BizNews is that it's just insane now. If you've got $80 billion market cap for something that's got assets, Bitcoin assets of worth $30 billion, then there's a lot of hot air in that. You've explained to us a little bit how Michael Saylor has been getting the momentum going or getting that flywheel going. But when you are talking to somebody who owns MicroStrategy today, how do you advise, or what would you suggest to them?
I would advise them to sell it, short it, and use the money to buy physical Bitcoin. And even if Bitcoin comes down, which we have seen, for example, just in the last week, you know, that 10% adjustment in the Bitcoin price from say 99 to 91, you know, resulted in about a 30% knock to MicroStrategy. So it is, you know, a 3 to 4 times levered vehicle. But as you said, Alec, yourself, you know, you've got to look at what the underlying value is of MicroStrategy and the amount of Bitcoin it has, less its debt. The share price represents, you know, 3x of that. So why would anyone buy an investment holding company where its assets are worth, net assets, less debt, are worth one third of what they're holding? I mean, today you can buy Remgro in South Africa at a 45% discount to what it owns. You know, why would you buy MicroStrategy just because it's in a levered in a Bitcoin asset, which is a highly volatile asset, at 3x of what it owns? You know, if you go back to when markets were real and people were normal, and any kind of asset like this would have traded at a massive discount to its underlying, you know, net asset value. But today we're in a different world with the Teslas and the Palantirs and the MicroStrategies. And, you know, I don't know when this all ends. I think it all started during COVID when rates were dropped to zero and the Fed pumped tens of trillions of dollars, you know, into trying to fix the problem. And things became non-real. You know, they're fictitious. They run by liquidity rather than by fundamentals. So it's very difficult to know, you know, at what point in time that all becomes real again. But when it does, I'm not sure you want to be holding a MicroStrategy share.
Mark Twain said history rhymes. You've been in the investment markets for a while. Have you seen anything like this, or is there any parallel from history that might give us an insight into where we're going?
There's probably a very small parallel on a very small scale before Y2K. You know, in the late 1990s, and we saw a little bit of that in South Africa because we had a large amount of technology companies that came to market, which, by the way, pretty much none of them exist today. So, you know, we saw that collapse, and you know, things were valued on multiples of revenue rather than on underlying earnings. You know, the internet was at its infancy, and everybody was going to make this enormous money. It reminds us a lot of this, you know, AR cycle we're seeing now, this cryptocurrency cycle, you know, many of the tech stocks. I mean, the difference is this is at an enormous scale where companies are worth literally trillions of dollars. It's not the case like that in South Africa. So we haven't seen that boom, but we are seeing it very much in the US. And you would have thought by now, given the fact that interest rates, you know, specifically in the US, have gone from a zero, you know, to some 4.5%, you would have thought you would have seen a little bit of a crack in that. But I think that crack may have come a year ago or so, but then we saw AI being kind of introduced at the same time, and we got another lifeline. And the leg up doesn't seem to be ending yet. And now we've got Donald Trump coming in with very pro-market policies and protectionism over the US. And so maybe that lasts a bit longer. It's very difficult to know, you know, when you need to bet against that. But I think that for now, it keeps going.
So when you go forward and have a look at years to come, we know from Nassim Taleb that the way he's written that it really is a fool's errand to try and predict the future. But you have to, from where you're sitting. So how do you position your portfolio today, given all these uncertainties, which just seem to be coming more and more to the fore?
Well, as you know, at 361, I mean, we manage a whole host of different type of portfolios. So it really depends on the mandate that you have in question. You know, the mandate in question, for example, in a hedge fund is very different to an equity portfolio. So equity portfolio has to be fully invested. And in that case, where it is fully invested, you know, we obviously are moving. We prefer being in the US than other global markets. We think, you know, given this latest round of potential tariffs and protectionism, you know, that the Trump administration would like to bring, we think that the US, given its full employment, given its reasonable GDP growth, still even under more restrictive conditions, is pretty good. We think that, you know, we'd rather be invested in the US for now than in other parts of the world. You know, we have seen big issues with China, other emerging markets. But we're also quite bullish still on South Africa. I mean, given the fact that we're coming off a very low base, you know, 10 years of GDP growth of between 0.6 and 0.8%. You know, we've now got a GNU, we've now got Eskom fixed. We are seeing some differences in other sectors And, you know, overall, we're more predisposed to being able to get a GDP number of 2% plus over the coming years. And we think that's something pretty reasonable given where we've been valued before. And as a result, we probably, you know, would have quite a bit of, we have got quite a bit of SA stock. We know these companies well. Think companies will do well here. And we think the US for a time will still do very well protecting its own industries.
Okay. Well, that's a lovely area to come back into the big moves or the big stories on the South African market. We've seen We Buy Cars, and I know that you know Dirk van der Walt from the BizNews conference, has just been shooting the lights out. It's now up at 45 Rand a share from listing earlier this year at 18. It would seem to perhaps be getting into the MicroStrategy area. Well, not quite, but what's your view on a stock like that? Do you just step back and wait, or do you think that it was underrated so badly in the beginning that it's only getting to fair value now?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination of the two. I think, you know, there were obviously very big disappointments and everything around the transaction capital management directors board when, you know, they're very much disappointed, particularly on the taxi business. And, you know, the business was massively underprovided. I mean, they're very smart guys, but I think overall We Buy Cars unfortunately came into the stable at a time when, you know, the stable was basically blowing up. And I think that, you know, that unfortunately did take away from some of the enormity of how well We Buy Cars had done as a business, you know, as a fledgling business and as a new business in South Africa, and how they changed the dynamics around how they, you know, effectively bought and sold motor vehicles. So, there was a lot of runway in what they did. It was very smart to obviously spin that out. And there still seems to be a bit of runway left in what they've got. The valuation, you know, I wouldn't have expected the valuation to double. But really, it's also come in a year of the GNU when the market is looking for South African companies with growth. We've seen a very big pickup, you know, in quality businesses. And we've seen a lot of small cap and mid cap stocks also do very well domestically. So it came at the right time. Everyone is looking for a growth opportunity. But the stock has gone up, as you say, over 100%. And it's difficult when you are, you know, in the business of retailing cars. You know, the consumer is still under pressure. I don't think we'd be buyers here at 45, but obviously it was very cheap around the 20 Rand mark.
And Boxer, the big IPO coming up this week. In fact, tomorrow, it is an even bigger IPO. New listing than we saw earlier this year with We Buy Cars. As a hedge fund primarily manager, has there been a smart way to play this?
Well, I think Pick and Pay was cheap. I mean, Pick and Pay, bear in mind, was in the teens approximately a year ago. I think touched down at 16 or 17 Rand while it was still pregnant with the full Boxer stake. You know, I think that the difficulty for Pick and Pay, the core business, is not profitable and he's been struggling and losing massive market share to, you know, ShopRite and Woolworths and to a lesser extent Spar. But overall, the Boxer business has been a very good business and it's done very well. You know, it started actually many, many years ago in Mattel and then expanded nationally and still has some very big expansion plans. The growth rates are not dissimilar to how ShopRite has been doing at the low end. So spinning it out makes very much good sense. I think the listing will do very well. You know, it was placed at the top of the range, was well oversubscribed. And, you know, we think it will probably trade closer to the 60 Rand mark tomorrow, as opposed to the 54 Rand placement price. And I think as with We Buy Cars, as with ShopRite, Clicks, et cetera, everybody who looks for quality growth businesses will be interested in owning Boxer. And I'm not sure what liquidity is going to be like. I think the negative part is you never know when more Boxer shares are going to come, because Pick and Pay is going to have to continually sell down in Boxer to try and fix the core Pick and Pay brand. And that's going to take some time, and that's going to be a continual overhang on the Pick and Pay share price. So you know, overall, we are bullish Boxer. We'd probably prefer it around 30 Rand in a pick and pay to rather own Boxer directly than pick and pay, but there will be some benefits for pick and pay.
Your colleague, Evan Walker, has really been helping the BizNews tribe to understand Boxer's appeal. I think he did tell us that it's one of those forever stocks. He said there were a few stocks you've got to have in your portfolio. Boxer being one, Bidcorp, I know, was another one he mentioned. Clicks, another one. Do you have the same view of what Evan told us?
I probably don't believe in forever stocks. I mean, I think there has been one forever stock we've held throughout the life at 361, and that was actually NASPAS, and we still hold. So, and it's not to say there haven't been periods where NASPAS has underperformed. There have been a lot of times, but it's given us a phenomenal return. I think it's more difficult in the retail space to say, you know, this is a forever owned business. The consumer goes through different cycles. We have interest rate changes and we have competitive changes, you know. So it's hard to say forever. I'm not a forever kind of person, but I think for now it is a good stock with good upside, good opportunities. You know, Sean Summers has come back to the pick and pay four, and the Boxer management, I believe, are outstanding. I don't know them personally, but Evan does. And I think that they've done and are going to do a very good job.
One of the issues that you've raised personally, and in fact, you wrote an op-ed. I haven't seen you writing many op-eds, Si, in the past, but there was one in Business Day earlier this week that you are very concerned about Treasury's proposed tax changes on unit trusts. Up to now, if unit trusts trade, whatever profits are made are treated as capital, but the proposal is that those trades will be treated, or the profits will be treated as revenue. Now, there's presumably a significant difference in the tax that the unit trust will pay, and as a result, what savers will get with what, after all, is after-tax money that they're putting in there.
Yes, I think that the point is not that it's necessarily after-tax money, because as you know, with all your after-tax money, whatever you invest in, whatever you do with it, you taxed again and again, whether it's on second indirect taxes or VAT or fuel taxes, or if it's capital gains tax or income tax on further investments. I think the problem with this legislation and or proposed legislation, and I feel sorry for the fiscus, and I understand the need to collect more direct taxes, but this is going to properly dampen everything as far as an investment perspective goes around South Africa. I mean, if we, for example, the proposal is to look at funds that, for example, trade too much or don't hold their shares, you know, for a period of 3 years. So relating the unit trust to basically be a private person who, for example, if he trades in his own name, would pay tax. I think that will totally disincentivize the industry altogether. So what would happen as a result of something like that? I can obviously talk from a 361 perspective. We would basically be forced to stop trading, which means that we couldn't realign our portfolios every day for inflows or outflows, etc., because you'd be triggering tax. I think foreign investors would look at this market and see the liquidity drying up and then, well, we don't need to even play in South Africa. We can now treat South Africa like the rest of Africa, where there's no liquidity, and don't waste our time, no matter how good the prospects of the economy look. We're not going to invest new money there. I think all our listed counterparts or corporates who are listed here, who look very much on a regular basis to our industry for capital support. I mean, there's been a whole lot of REITs recently that needed capital to expand their businesses. They need it in a very short space in time. They come to the CIS industry. They come to hedge funds and normal collective investment schemes and say, guys, we need some capital. Can you provide us? We'll underwrite, you know, half a billion, a billion, a few billion rand very quickly. We'll have to move portfolios around. And this all creates the liquidity that markets require. It helps companies grow, meet their capex requirement, meet their ambitions to grow further in the investment cycle. It brings foreign investors to South Africa. It promotes savings and investments from private people. This is their savings. You know, South Africans, unlike Americans and all people in developed world, haven't had, for example, primary properties that become their investments over their life cycle because property hasn't gone up here for 10 or 15 years. So they've been gearing a primary investment asset that's actually declined. This is their one way of creating wealth. And to go and tax this now and make it actually just unfair because, you know, if, for example, talking from my own standpoint, I would just sell all the funds and go buy some foreign funds. Foreign funds aren't taxed within what goes on within the funds. When I sell the fund, ultimately, I'll pay capital gains tax. But no one's going to look in the fund and see where that fund traded on a specific day or happened to make a short-term profit versus a long-term profit. I think it's absolutely just not thought out, this proposed legislation. It is the second time it's come around. It came around in 2018 and 19. We thought that Treasury had very much, kicked it to touch, realizing how much the industry means to investment in the country, to all the various corporates, to the private investors who are growing their wealth over time. But I guess, we'll have to see what happens with this legislation.
Is there any abuse in this area, though? Have there been asset managers who've been trading too aggressively and as a result invited this response from Treasury?
Well, I suppose you could look at the thing is the liquidity in South Africa overall has dried up terribly. You know, Treasury first went with this introduction a number of years ago, which I don't think was very well thought out, where they increased the foreign investment allowance in Reg 28 from 25 to as high as 45% now. That caused a huge flood out of South Africa, and liquidity drew up and market valuations deteriorated immensely over the last number of years. I mean, if it wasn't for this GNU now and some renewed optimism, I'm not sure where local valuations would be. And we've started to see a big pickup, you know, in corporate fundraising, in share placements, in businesses starting to grow again because the valuations have become a little bit better, and liquidity's picked up a little bit over the last few months. Yes, there probably are some funds that trade ridiculously that maybe need to be looked at on a separate basis that are really just trying to make daily profits, etc. But I think for 90-something percent of the industry, you know, most decisions are made on a long-term basis, trying to unlock long-term capital growth for your underlying investment clients. Whether you're doing it in a hedge fund, or you're doing it in a long-only CIS, or you're doing it in a balanced fund CIS, I think your objectives are all the same. Often your benchmark is different. So I think where National Treasury's also got this discussion paper horribly wrong is they assume that hedge funds are more risky than normal equity funds. We would differ absolutely, or we'd be on the exact opposite side of Treasury. And we would happy to discuss that with Treasury at any point, because all you have to do is measure the drawdowns, measure the standard deviation, measure the volatility of the majority of hedge funds in South Africa, and you'll realize that they are giving you lower risk and better risk-adjusted returns than actually normal equity funds in the market. But I think that's really misunderstood by Treasury. But yeah, as you say, Alec, there may be a couple of funds here and there, but they're immaterial. This is a 3.5 trillion rand industry that needs to be protected, that needs to grow. And ultimately, Treasury will get great taxes out of the industry. You know, as investors move from one fund to another, I think where there potentially has been small abuses of the system is, for example, these continual Section 42s into portfolios, where clients could effectively move their own personal portfolios into a unit trust and defer the ultimate capital gains tax at a point in time in the future. Maybe Treasury should look at something around that and maybe stop those from happening. I think that to be a taxable event. I think there have been some players in the industry abusing that. And, from that point of view, we'd be happy to look at reasonable legislation. But I think this would be extremely negative for South Africa. It would dry up liquidity, you know, would stop normal investment from coming in, would stop companies from being able to raise capital efficiently. I mean, right now, this morning, the last time we spoke 90 days ago, was actually the day after Anglos came to place Amplats, their 5% stake. And there's another 5% that I'm sure you've read about that's been announced last night and issued this morning. I mean, everybody would have had to make place for that. You're talking about, you know, 10 to 12 billion rand of new money that's required to help Anglos effectively pre-position itself for what's coming up. You know, how does the industry take that? They have to rotate. We have to sell other stuff, create liquidity, take 12 billion of equity value in an overnight, basically, situation done very quickly. So, you know, trying to tax us for doing that now would not be in the best interests of the underlying investors. So really, this market functions because of many of the CISs that are able to provide liquidity, you know, to these type of events. And stopping that would be a big mistake.
Looks a bit like first level thinking, whereas more engagement, more realizing there's a heck of a lot that you don't know that you don't know, would open up perhaps a different avenue of thought. They want money, though, in Treasury, and even the best logic in the world might not fly in this case.
I think a growth mandate is what ultimately brings money. If our GDP prints at 2% or closer to 3%, companies make more money, our businesses grow, the amount of corporate tax, you know, secondary tax on dividends, everything picks up when the economy picks up. Trying to stunt growth and take short-term taxes definitely doesn't, in the long run, help the country. You collect more taxes by following a growth mandate rather than trying to tax in the short term.
I'm glad you waved that flag, because the JSE needed flags to be waved for so many years in the past and just ignored them when the few people did wave them. But it does appear as though there is perhaps more engagement and more collaboration going on now. But broadly speaking, when you look at South Africa, and you have been bullish on South Africa since before the election and clearly after the Government of National Unity, where are you right now? Has the improvement in local stocks taken them to a level where they now are reflecting adequate risk return and that you'd perhaps be looking elsewhere for better growth?
Well, I think a large portion of that revaluation has happened. So, you know, we're not buying a fortune more of South African equity. At the same time, we're not necessarily big sellers of either. I mean, we do have some, I think, big pluses. We have the two-pot system, which is requiring, you know, getting quite substantial money out of the system. And yes, people can argue that that's negative for the market because pension funds have to sell their underlying equities to facilitate that. And I would think that's happening to a lot of the larger asset managers. I mean, we at 361 are still seeing net inflows as a result of as you know, while this two-pot system withdrawal is taking place. I think we're starting to get some noises from some of the underlying retailers. We saw Pepkor's numbers yesterday that actually it's making a difference. There are some pickups in revenue, so spending is getting better. We have seen the start of interest rate cutting cycle. We do think the SARB, by the way, is behind that cycle. So, you know, we'd expect them to be a little bit more aggressive given where current inflation numbers sit. You know, we would think by now we would have had at least a 50-point cut. I think they're going to be sticking to their 25-basis-point cut, and they'd be very conservative. I mean, we have a very high real interest rate in South Africa, and we'd like to see that come down further. It is another thing we have been pushing quite hard, but I guess, you know, that they may have their reasons for going slowly. But overall, you know, that does lead us to, you know, plus the Eskom issue, which has got a, you know, obviously in the base and got some upside. It does lead us to still be reasonably positive. I think a lot of this two-pot withdrawal system has helped the credit books at this stage across the market more so than the turnover. You know, it's a point in time of the year in November now where people are behind. They need to, you know, facilitate their final school fee payment. They need to get their bank overdrafts maybe down a little bit so they're able to go on a holiday, et cetera, et cetera. So I think a lot of money is being fed into the credit system. So we're seeing a big improvement in retail books and banks' books. And I think banks, particularly in our mind, look, you know, particularly cheap. We're still getting a fantastic high single-digit dividend yield. You've got growth. The book's looking better. And we've got some big CapEx cycles coming up. If you look at the overall CapEx cycle in South Africa, there seems to be a big pickup. We've seen renewables. A lot of money has to be spent on water infrastructure. We're seeing a lot of money coming back into roads, other infrastructure. So overall, we are still pretty bullish South Africa. But again, some of that run has happened in the price, but we wouldn't be sellers. We would be more buyers than sellers currently.
When you mentioned banks, often people will stick with Capitec as the high growth bank and FirstRand as the blue chip bank. But are there others? Would you look at Nedbank, Absa, even Standard Bank?
Well, I think Absa's been the forgotten, basically, stepchild of the commercial banks. In our mind, Absa looks by far the cheapest. And we spent a lot of time analyzing the banks, and we're actually very positive Absa at this point in the cycle, probably relative to the others. We also do own FirstRand, and FirstRand has been good, but has this overhang now with this credit motor issue in the UK, which I think until it's resolved may just be a small cloud over the FirstRand business. And Capitec's very difficult to justify, always has been very difficult to justify. It's a phenomenal business. Trades very much like Nubank, NU Bank, that came out of South America. And Berkshire Hathaway at one stage had a big stake in that. You know, this online fintech financial services business. So Capitec, as you know, you've had them on your stage many times. It's not really viewed as a bank anymore, but rather as a fintech company. Can't really use the old metrics of price to book that you use in a normal bank, you know, because this is really an online bank, and it's difficult to justify the valuation. And we don't own much of it. We wouldn't be shorted right now because it's just a forever darling of the market. But overall, the management team at Capitec have no doubt done the best job out of all the banks. But the valuation is captured in our view, you know, very much in that share price. And we tend to probably look at the cheapest of the banks, which is Absa at this point in the cycle.
Si, before we go, we have the National Health Insurance proposal in South Africa, which hasn't been taken off the table by any means. It could still see a huge battle in the government of national unity. But it has had an impact on Discovery's rating. Discovery being an international company to a large degree, yet the share price there being held back. When you look at South African champions, Discovery is certainly right up there as one of the champions of South Africa, particularly the way that it's operated globally. And I guess we could talk about Investec as well in a moment. But are you feeling the market is overemphasizing the danger of National Health on Discovery, given that it does have other ballasts now outside of the local operation?
Well, it's quite interesting you say that. I think, if anything, the market has discounted NHI not becoming a big thing, realized practically the government can't afford to implement it in the same way that they propose. We've heard rumblings that potentially, you know, private healthcare insurance providers will be able to exist in a parallel system. And we imagine that very much will be the case. Discovery, for example, is a business we never owned for 10 years, literally for 10 years. And I think the share price went nowhere in 10 years while we didn't own it. And we owned other insurance businesses. But this year, we stepped up and it's in our top five this year and was there before the GNU. As we saw for the first time, the business starting to generate real cash. This new Discovery Bank growing much faster than anticipated. And insurance business is holding up better than we anticipated. And in fact, even the life business starting to look better. So it's, you know, Discovery was always going to have a very long life cycle because it never bought businesses in the industry. It created them from zero. So creating a business from zero, obviously, you know, requires probably big losses in the beginning, big investment, massive cash outflow, and requires a very long life cycle. But eventually that life cycle matures and starts hopefully generating big profits. And we think that business, you know, tipped this year earlier. And that's why we've seen the stock closer to 110 Rand earlier in the year and now closer to 195. And it's up maybe 70%. So it's been a phenomenal winner for 361 and for obviously country and Discovery. And I think that it's finally tipped over. And obviously, given all their technology, and given the fact that it's not a traditional healthcare insurance business and it's global, and it has some proper RP and health data embedded in its model, I think that, yeah, it could still surprise further to the upside. So we've been pretty bullish there, and I think we'll do well. And on Investec, I think the big plus in Investec's been a bank that's also turned the corner, substantially, I think, since the old management left the business and new management came in. And I think what we've seen is a consolidation of that business model. I think costs have been taken out in a big way out of that business. Business has been realigned. Non-core things have been, put to the side. And the business has got some renewed vigor and done phenomenally well since then. So, yeah, I think it's difficult from this point because it has had a big run, but it has been very well managed over the last number of years.
A lot of the stocks that we've discussed today, and thank you for being so generous with your insights, have had a good run. Is there anything that the retail investor can look at that has been ignored, perhaps because the shares are tightly held and difficult for institutions to participate in?
Well, I think there are a whole host of pretty well-run mid and small cap businesses that, if they got a few things right, could return to the glory days. I mean, one that we own, Famous Brands, for example, it requires some changes, maybe getting rid of some operational head office costs, realigning the business a little bit. You remember it used to trade at 140, 160 Rand many years ago. It's a good business. Fast food is doing well. It's linked to all this technology and food. That one, for example, has got the potential, but it needs some changes. Businesses like Remgro, Roynet, for example, where Roynet and Remgro, in fact. Roynet, some of the parts, well-run businesses, providing electricity infrastructure, got a defense business that's definitely worth something in this era. There could be upside in those. Remgro, as I mentioned before, massive discount to its underlying NAV of investments, and it holds Discovery as well in First Rand and other unlisted companies. So I think there are a host of good businesses, and Absa, which I mentioned before, which I think is being unfairly prejudiced or unfairly smashed in this market environment, due to historic reasons. But if you look at it at this point in time, it looks to be much cleaner, the book in a healthy position and growing. So I think there are, many good opportunities. I think the more difficult ones to put our name behind over a medium to longer term, on a medium to longer term basis, are obviously the resource stocks, very much at the mercy of China, at the mercy of the US in respect of tariffs. We're not quite sure if infrastructure ever comes back to China. They obviously overspent and over-delivered for so many years. There's a lot that needs to unwind out of that system. So that's a lot more difficult to call. But I think in our South African retail, industrial, financial businesses, property businesses, I still think there is some good, reasonable value there for investors.
Sy Jacobs is the co-founder and chief executive of 361. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.